Recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge, high atop the Quartermass Building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia. It's Phantasmo After Dark with your host Rob Floyd and co-host Phyllis Floyd. Our topic tonight, the Incredible Melting Man.
Well, hey everybody, good evening. Welcome back to the old podcast.
Hello.
Hey Phyllis.
Hi Rob.
And so we revisited The Incredible Melting Man the other night. Actually, I revisited it. I think this was your first time watching it, right?
Yes. I think I may have seen parts of it with you before, but I've never watched it all the way through until now.
Well, see, this is good because it'll give a fresh perspective on it from somebody who's never seen it before.
Let's hope so.
This movie is notorious in a lot of ways. Hell, I remember ever since I was a kid, I wanted to see this movie. When it came out, I never got to see it. I was really young when this came out. My parents wouldn't take me to see rated R horror movies.
They wouldn't. Why not?
Well, because I was like 7 years old.
Imagine that.
7 or 8 years old at the time. The first monster movie actually I did see on the screen was the De Laurentiis King Kong. And, that was King Kong. That's not going to be a lot of gore and blood and stuff. I remember seeing a trailer for this at the old Great Bridge Twin Theater, where I saw a lot of movies growing up as a kid, a little mom-and-pop hometown theater kind of thing, two screens. And I remember seeing this trailer and just being fascinated by it. The guy walking around and is melting as he's walking around looking for, humans to attack, to eat, to stay alive. But also I remember buying, I believe it was Starlog... number 11, I think, one of the first sci-fi, other than Famous Monsters, one of the first, genre sci-fi magazines that I ever bought. On the cover was a young man named Rick Baker.
Gee, that sounds familiar.
And a lot of different staged melting head props and a couple of human heads with, with the mouth open and all.
Can see how that would grab you.
Well, yeah, I was like, wow, I gotta have this. I might still have that somewhere. It might be up in the attic in a box or something. And I was just fascinated, by this movie. And for some reason, I never got to see it. Well, of course, that was before, VCRs were everywhere and videotapes. And then later on, I just didn't really think about it too much. And it wasn't one that was out there a lot. I guess if you wanted to see it, you had to really dig for it. Until recently that it had come out on DVD and then Blu-ray, which might have been close to the same time, I'm not sure. But I did manage to get a copy on Blu-ray not too long ago. And we watched it. I enjoyed the hell out of it.
I enjoyed it quite a bit as well. It was, there were moments where I wanted to hit people, but,
Well, right off the bat, okay, it's not the greatest film ever made.
Well, no.
It is definitely a low-budget, quickie B-type horror movie, but it has all the earmarks of a classic drive-in movie or grindhouse movie. Everything that you want or expect to see in one of those is in this movie at some point or another. You've got, you got your monster, your creature, your killer, whatever. Kind of outlandish kind of killer. You've got a bit of nudity.
Just a bit.
Right, right in the middle of the movie for really no reason other than to show nudity.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's Cheryl Rainbow Smith, who was in tons of grindhouse movies in the mid-late 70s, early 80s, from Caged Heat, etc. And it's like they put her in there just like, well, she's got to be in it. It's like the law. She has to be in these movies. So she's just thrown in there in the middle. And then you've got the tragic ending, and then the classic 70s, it's kind of a twofer, the ending, because you get the tragic, there's no hope, it's all, he's dead, it's done, it's over, it was such a tragic thing that happened to him, but then you get the, but it's gonna happen again.
Right.
With a voiceover.
It's just gonna start over.
Yeah.
Well, when I first saw that part, I immediately thought of War of the Worlds, because that's exactly how how that happens. Well, I'm sure, that happens in more than one film, obviously, but...
Yeah. Well, this is really kind of... It was supposed to be a tribute... let me back up. The writer-director actually wrote it originally as a comedy, kind of a parody of the 50s and 60s B sci-fi, monster from space type movies.
Right. But the producers didn't agree, right?
The producers wanted to make it more of just a straight horror picture. If they thought, you know, well, that makes more money than comedy mm-hmm. horror movies, at least at the time anyway. This was, like, 77, I think, is when this came out. So, incidentally, while they were making it, the producers were making changes, and then in the editing room, some changes were made. So, you could say you get a bit of an uneven movie, because there are bits of what was supposed to be comedy.
The
director says it was comedy, but it doesn't play as comedy.
Really. No, and you know, I like some dry humor, but I didn't. It wasn't even dry. It just wasn't really funny at all.
And if the director thinks that those bits were funny,
right,
and they were left in, then I'd be interested to see, but I'd hate to see what his vision was, because he obviously did not understand comedy.
Apparently not.
The part where they find his melted ear on the tree, they said, yeah, you know, how can you take that seriously? I'm like, well, because that would have happened. It would have fallen off. I mean,
yeah, the dude's ear fell off. Yeah. And it's not like it fell off in a funny way.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like
he's melting.
Look, it's his ear. Wah, wah. No. There's bits of skin and melted goop everywhere that he goes. So that wasn't funny. And then there's a scene where the doctor in the movie, the guy who's looking for him, his wife's mother and her boyfriend are coming to visit, and their little exchange in the car, and they get out of the car on the side of the road, and that's supposed to be funny. And really the only reason that you know it's supposed to be funny is because of the music they play during this, that doom 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 doom.
Right.
Because the scene isn't written funny.
No,
and they're bad
actors,
so it's not delivered with any kind of comic timing or humor at all. So I'm not sure the director himself really understood what he was trying to do. I think this is one case where the producers or the suits made a smarter decision than going with the original vision.
I think you're probably right. And I am not familiar with the director of this. Has he done anything else that I would know?
What was
his name? William Sachs?
I don't think so. Why don't you look him up and see real quick, or go through our files, rather, here in the lounge.
I will check the
files.
Here
in the Phantasmo Lounge, we have a massive reference library of cult films to look through.
Well, that part's actually pretty
true. That is kind of true. But we also have the interwebs that all the kids like these days. And
He's listed for directing 12 different movies.
And what are a few of those?
All right.
Or, hell, what are all 12? We got the time.
Well, there's a short in 1969 called Breakfast. Then there's a movie in 1971 called South of Hell Mountain. 1974, There Is No 13. That mm-hmm. actually sounds familiar to me.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, I'm not sure. 76, Secrets of the Gods documentary. Then in 77, of course, Incredible Melting Man. 78, The Force Beyond. 79, Van Nuys Boulevard. 80.
Oh, I've seen that.
Galaxina. That sounds familiar.
I know of Galaxina. Yeah, right? That's a notorious film.
85, Hot Chili. 91, The Last Hour.
91, wow.
92, Judgment. In 2002, something called Spooky House that looks like it might be a family-friendly type.
Yeah, there's only a couple of those I've heard. Galaxina being one of them. Go back to that There Is No 13th Hour.
That sounds very familiar to me.
It sounds like Wes Craven might have had something to do with that. Some of the research we were doing for one of those panels, that I swear that title came up.
William Sachs is writer-director. Uh-huh.
I know we've heard, or maybe it was, I could be wrong.
Yeah, I'm not seeing anything
okay.
that would
well,
jump
anyway,
out.
So he hasn't really done anything else of note. I've seen Van Nuys Boulevard, and that's just one product of the times in the late 70s, early 80s or whatever. On Van Nuys Boulevard follows these group of people and they're, you know, what happens to them over the course of a couple weeks. Galaxina, never seen it, heard of it. Notorious bad sci-fi movie, but Incredible Melting Man. Let's get back to that because that's what we're talking about.
Before you jump on, I would just like to say that I see here that he was a producer on Leprechaun in 1993. Just so
okay, that says it all right there.
There you go.
That shows you he does not know what's funny. But anyway, so I got to hand it to the producers in this case, anyway, for going with a straight horror picture.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard you say that before.
No, because usually, you know, the suits don't know what the hell they're talking about, don't know what they're doing. You know, what's going on in DC and Marvel right now is proof of that. But and Hollywood in general. Because, you know, there's not original thought going on there. But in this case, it works as a straight science fiction, horror, thriller picture. Does it work well? Well, no, not really, because, you know.
It has a few moments.
Yeah, it has some moments. It's not horrible. It's not. I've seen worse. I enjoy this movie. It moves a little slow, and there's a couple things that don't make sense in it.
That's
but
true.
Overall, it's enjoyable. The special effects are great. I mean, it's Rick Baker. It's one of his early jobs. The first job he got after King Kong, after he worked on the Dealer and His King Kong, the first big job he got. And, I mean, they're top-notch. You know, the melting effect, everything, it looks great the whole time. It's gross. The best scene, though, the best effect is when he rips the head off the fisherman, which you don't see. You don't see him rip the head off, but you see the head being thrown and land in the creek, and it rolls, you know, goes down the creek and then goes over the waterfall. And when it falls and hits a rock at the bottom and just not really explodes, but cracks the skull open, and a piece as it rolls forward, it flicks the piece out towards the camera. Man, you couldn't plan that any better. That looks great. It was a great look. It was a great looking head. It didn't look like a fake head.
No,
obviously really fake head. You know, it looked great. And that when it hit and it didn't explode. It just cracked open just enough. Yep. You know, and the sound was great too when it.
Well, you know, the weird thing about that is, you know, you see the head when it. You don't see it get ripped off, but you see when it's been ripped off and then it lands in the water and it starts to go down the creek or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it cuts away and it goes to another scene.
Oh, I can't remember
what scene it goes to after that, but it goes to a whole other scene for a few minutes.
A couple of minutes. And then it comes back to the head still floating down the creek, which I don't know why they split that up like that.
It was a weird cut down the river. I'm not sure why they did it.
They could have just
weird.
They could have just had it in one straight shot of the creek, the head going in the creek and then going in a waterfall, instead of breaking it up like that. But I comment on that when we were watching it. It kind of takes you out of it for a second.
It's like, oh, we're back to the head again. Here it is.
It's like it's been floating down there for half a day.
Yeah, you have no idea.
Yeah. Oh, but to backtrack a little bit, though, and start out briefly what the movie is about is it starts off with these three astronauts in space, and they're supposed to go through Saturn's rings and, you know, take readings and land on Saturn, which you can't land on Saturn because it's a gaseous
unless I am much mistaken, there's nothing to land on.
Yeah, and the rings, you know, probably would have a frozen ice crystal, so they would have, like, destroyed the ship. But anyway, so take that aside.
Yeah, you just kind of forget about
that. They're going in the Saturn's rings.
No real science there, folks.
So something happens there, and the ship comes back to Earth, and only one astronaut's alive.
His name is Steve, by
the way. Steve.
Yeah, Steve. I can't remember his last name.
Steve Astronaut. And he's starting to melt, and he runs out of the hospital, and that's it. He runs out of the hospital and is running away because he's melting away, and he has to have human cells to live.
Right, and I think that it must be affecting his mind, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, not just the trauma of, oh my God, I'm melting, but he knows he needs to have human cells to live. I don't know how he's put that together.
Yeah, that's
we
never...
We don't know how he knows
And
this.
We don't know how the scientist knows that.
No idea. Nor do we really know why he's melting. They don't ever... Now, I mean, we kind of assume some type of radiation.
Yeah, well, they say he is radioactive.
Well, that's true.
Because they use a Geiger counter to track him.
That's true. So it's a good assumption, but we don't know.
And we don't know why, but he's walking away. He's leaving the hospital, walking through the backwoods and stuff, and he... You know, kills a few people along the way, and he ends up, his scientist doctor friend who's looking for him, he ends up going to their house.
He gets there eventually. It takes
eventually,
him all day, I think.
Well, a couple of days, maybe. Who knows?
Know.
But he's going there, and then he kills the army general that's there watching his wife, and then he leaves.
And we don't know
without going in the house or going after the wife, and he leaves and goes away. And we don't know why he was going there or why he's going away. They never say. And I'm not sure they say in any relation.
I think they just said that he was a close friend.
Yeah.
But I can understand why he might be going there. If he's friends with him and, you know, he knows he's a doctor, perhaps even if he's not in his right mind, perhaps subconsciously he's trying to go to his friend's house and get help.
Could be.
But then he just leaves. I don't get it.
Yeah. but the and that's really, I guess, kind of the that's the basic plot. And we've talked about the bad things about it. You know, things kind of bring it down. But the good stuff about it is it's a straight tribute almost to those 50s, 60s, well, 50s more, science fiction movies, because it's kind of a remake almost of the Quatermass Experiment.
Right.
And almost like any of those standard movies like Hideous Sun Demon and things like that, where the guy turns into a monster, something turns him into a creature, and some radiation from space or a comet or something, and he is on the run to get away from people, and they're after him.
Right.
You know, and through happenstance or whatever, he kills people along the way, either to live or because they just get in his way. And he dies up high on top of some machinery or a power plant or something like that. Like, yeah. A lot of them do. It happened in Hideous Sun Demon.
Mm-hmm.
I think it happens in Indestructible Man. But that's just kind of a thing, you know. But some of the stuff that works really well, the him wandering alone through the woods and stuff, really kind of is shot pretty good. And the melting effect is great. The one part after he scares, the little girl finds him and she screams and runs away, and his eye just kind of slides out of the socket.
that one's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, and it's pretty cheesy, and it's pretty good all in the same time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I couldn't decide whether it was really cheesy or was really cool.
No, I liked it.
And
I liked it a lot.
But it wasn't bad. You know, it was a pretty good effect. But it was kind of funny, too. So maybe that's part of the humor they were talking about. I don't know. But the whole time he's walking, and his inner monologue, he's hearing the last things he remembers hearing, I guess.
Yeah.
He's hearing Mission Control and the stuff that was going over the radio.
There's
while he
countdown.
Was in the, yeah, while he was in the countdown's kind of,
yeah,
kind of foreboding, you know, kind
it
of.
Well, it's more so later, because he hears it a couple of times throughout the film. You know, you hear it in the very end when he's pretty much dying, but you hear it earlier on too, and it doesn't. It's not like it goes from 10 to 5 and stops or something.
Yeah,
it does get down.
Yeah, and it's just going throughout. You hear it various times.
Yeah.
The music in it was really good. I thought for a low budget film, the music was really, built the suspense.
Yeah, it did
throughout the film, except for the with the parents. But everything else, I think, worked better than your average low-budget film.
There was one scene where I swear I was hearing the Jaws theme.
There was one where it did sound like kind of a take on it, a little faster.
Yeah, it was a little faster, but it was,
the Jaws
it was
theme.
Definitely a bit of a ripoff there.
Yeah, but the rest of it was pretty good.
Yeah, I agree.
Rick Baker, in some of the supplemental stuff on the disc, talks about how, and some of the other stuff I read, how he sculpted 3 distinct different stages of the Melting Man.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy, it was Alex Rebar, I think was the actor's name that played him, was such a dick to work with. And he didn't want to wear the different things for some reason, or he wouldn't do the makeup or something. So they just had the one,
right,
really, that
mm-hmm.
they just kept adding more goop to,
mm-hmm.
so to make it look different that way.
Yeah.
It would have been cool to see what the ones that he did. I think you can see him. You can Google it and see, you know, see him. But you can't really see from that as what it would look like on a person.
Yeah, what it would have done with all the makeup and stuff on. And
Yeah, that would have been really cool to see.
Well, you know, we started to watch the commentary with this on the Blu-ray release. And it was so distracting. And I know that sounds kind of ironic to say that commentary would be distracting to the film. Of course it is, Phyllis. But the commentary, I believe, was just the director, right?
What yeah, it was just the director. And
for the first at least 10, 15 minutes, really all he did was bitch about the fact that the producers didn't do what he wanted and that he had to change all the scenes. And the reason there's... Oh, that was interesting, though. He did say the reason you see the one big goof everybody seemed to be talking about on everything I read when we were researching this was when the nurse goes in to see him with blood in her, you know, the blood bottles in her hand, that he turns around and she can see him, you know, on all his melty glory, and she gets scared. He comes after her, she drops the bottles, and then blood gets all over her shoes. Well, the next time you see her, she's running down the hallway, and she's pristine white shoed again. Apparently, that's a big issue for people, a big goof.
You know, it didn't even faze me. I mean, I noticed it, but I was like, it didn't. But it didn't make me go, oh man.
It apparently bothered William Sachs very much because he said that it looked really stupid having her run down there with no blood on her shoes after she had just dropped blood all over her shoes. But the reason that happened was because the producers made me change the opening.
Well, you know, the thing that bothered me about that scene is this didn't bother me. It's in slow motion because you got to have slow motion in 70s. Horror pictures.
You just have to.
But she's running down this long hallway, and there's nobody chasing her.
That is very true.
You know, it shows him
bust through a glass door
for no reason
at the end, and there's nobody behind her.
Yeah, and she's bust through the glass door, and it's broad daylight.
It is.
And he later on, you see him come walking across the parking lot, or something, and nobody sees any of this in broad daylight at a hospital.
There's not a single soul
in a government hospital.
Yeah, the hallways are empty.
Yeah. So, but you know, she's running. That didn't bother me as much as running down this long hallway. And yeah, it was in slow motion, so okay, it seemed longer. But you don't see him even come out of the door way at the other end behind her. That would have been kind of creepy, I think, if they would have done that. Or you got more of a, oh, there he is.
Yeah.
Run faster.
Right.
But there's nothing at all.
Do you want to know what bothered me about that scene?
What's that?
When he first turns around and she sees him, the stupid gauze that's like hanging
stuck
from one
the side
thread
of his nose.
Hanging from the side of his nose drove me crazy.
Yeah, he kept turning around and moving and it wouldn't fall off. Yeah, that bugged me too.
It's the little things, I suppose, but that was so distracting. It's like, dude, rip that off your nose.
Yeah, that got on my nerves a little too. But you know, I keep going back to saying I did enjoy it though. And if you enjoy films like these late 70s horror films, like It's Alive, it had that kind of feel to it, kind of like it was made by the same people. I mean, that kind of style.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of hard to explain. You just have to know it when you see films like that from that late 70s, not early 70s, because there's a marked difference in the way that overall thing, the feel of these films. And yeah, it's weird because I don't think I ever saw this show up on late night TV. I mean, I'm sure it did.
I do not know.
But I don't remember ever seeing it.
I know that MST3K did this as an episode.
They did. I don't know if... I wonder if Dr. Madblood ever showed this. I don't remember if he did or not.
You will have to ask.
I'll have to ask somebody over there about that. Because like I said, again, I never got a chance to see it.
Right.
You know, as a kid. And I'm surprised I don't remember, but there was... I found out recently, we both found out, there was a Collegeville... a kid's boxed Halloween costume of Incredible Melting Man. And it's pretty damn gory for, you know, the mask anyway.
Yeah.
For a little kid's costume.
There was also apparently a makeup set.
Oh,
for
yeah.
Incredible Melting Man. I think that was the only merchandise for this.
I think I remember that, seeing that.
A little makeup. I mean, and the makeup kit makes sense because, well, that's what the whole thing is. But yeah, for a little kid's costume and makeup set, that is pretty gory.
But,
lots
you know.
Of goop.
At least there was something, some merchandising for it, you know. And I tell you, if I would have known, I would have had it as a kid. I would have looked for it anyway.
Well, perhaps you shall run across it in future.
Nah, Clayton will find it. yeah, it's. I believe it's still available on Blu-ray. If anybody's looking for it, I'm not sure if it's online or on YouTube. I haven't checked that yet. I'll definitely post the trailer though. Well, there's two trailers. Oh, that's what we got to talk about, but. I'll post the trailer on the Facebook page after before this goes up or right when this is going up, along with, of course, a bunch of pictures and things like I always do. But there were two trailers and two posters for this initially. And one, they were trying to capitalize on Rick Baker since he had just come off of King Kong.
Right.
And I believe Star Wars had already come out at this point. And he had a little bit to do with the Cantina aliens and that.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he worked with Dick Smith like for a day or so on The Exorcist.
Right.
Just helping him out,
yeah,
basically.
Rick Baker's quote, wherever I was watching, whatever interview it was basically he was just helping out as labor. He said that he didn't offer any creative ideas. He didn't come up with any cool makeups. He was just lending a hand.
Yeah, I mean, Dick Smith was like, his mentor and who he looked up to. So he just went, he was helping him out. But they built this campaign, or they tried to, on like, creator of The Exorcist and Star Wars Aliens and It's Alive, or I think he worked on It's Alive, and King Kong, Rick Baker creates the new horror monster for the decade, And Baker didn't know they were doing that. And when he found out, he got kind of pissed because he's like, I didn't do that. I didn't do that either. That's not me, you know. So they changed it and just went with the straight, you know, Incredible Melting Man poster and another trailer that didn't have that in it. But I'll see if I can post both trailers because that's kind of interesting to see how they were building that.
I think that was listed on, or not listed, but it was shown on the Blu-ray, wasn't it? Because didn't we see
that? Yeah, it's on the Blu-ray. Yeah, yeah. Both trailers are on the Blu-ray. I don't know. I didn't look through the still gallery. There might be a picture of the poster, too.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, Rick Baker, man, you know, he's done so much over the years. I don't even need to go into that because that'll be another hour or so just talking about him. But people who, you know, work for him, Rob Bottin came from him and, you know, all these other guys. And I think Baker just retired recently or said he was retiring, you know, because, you know, he's done his stuff and he's ready to take it easy. But he was the go-to guy for the longest time there.
Yeah, he does amazing work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you want a gorilla or a monkey of any kind, Baker's the guy. That was like his specialty. Starting from Schlock, the John Landis early masterpiece. You haven't seen that, have you?
I have not.
Oh, yeah. We'll have to watch that. I've got a fan-produced copy of that. we'll have to watch. That's something special. That was made as a comedy and stayed as a comedy. Yeah. Schlock, the missing link. But, God, that's... we could do a podcast on that in about 15 minutes, I think.
That bad, huh?
Well, you know, okay, I've only seen it once. And it was on a little portable DVD player. So, I'll give it another shot. And see, and then reserve, you know, and then pass judgment on it. So
there are very few movies that you won't give another shot.
Oh, I'll watch any kind of crap over and over again. And the good ones I'll watch maybe once or twice. But anyway. But no, you know, this one, like I said, it's not the greatest movie, but I did enjoy it and I'd watch it again, you know, with some people who haven't seen it. That's always fun.
Yeah.
But it really has that same, it's not breaking any new ground. I mean, it's that same kind of story, like I said, from like Quatermass, where, you know, guy goes into space, comes back with some kind of disease, radiation, or fungus that turns him into a monster. And he's trying to get away from people and trying to live by whatever he's absorbing or eating other people, you know.
Well, you know, you didn't talk about the ending scene.
Oh, yeah.
One of the most poignant moments was when the Incredible Melting Man Steve is dying, he's gonna eventually melt away. So not only do you get to see everything melt, you know, the big final melt,
he walks up against, he's only got one eye left. Yeah, he walks and leans against this wall and then kind of slides down
into some trash cans.
Yeah, right next to some trash cans, sits down, and you see his head starting to get kind of like
droopy,
kind of drooping, kind of caving in a little bit, and he holds up like he's looking at his hand,
right?
And he's still hearing those last thoughts, and as the thoughts that he's hearing of the voiceover from the astronaut mission control, it starts to kind of fade away as his head starts to
kind of garbled sounding or something.
His vision starts to go blurry and then go black, and then his hand falls and his head kind of caves in.
Yeah, and implodes. There's like a moment of black where he can't see anymore, and then he dies.
And it's really kind of, you feel for him, man, that for a couple of seconds there, because it's like, holy crap, this guy's feeling and seeing himself die, and there's nothing he can do about it. And it's happening right there. You see it happen as the stuff is dripping off of him. And it's really a great scene. I mean, the whole movie, that is the best scene in the movie. And the director, before I say that, and at the end, when he melts completely, and when you see, you know, the next thing you see is just, it's daylight, and there's rags of clothes, and blood, goop, and all melted stuff on the ground, and I guess the janitor or cleanup guy for the complex that he's at there, you know, just comes up and starts picking up the scraps, throwing them in a trash can, and sweeping up.
Before he starts sweeping up, you see the janitor guard walking towards the trash cans.
Yeah.
And he's got a handheld radio. He's listening of course, the newscasters are saying how, you know, they're sorry they don't get to talk to the astronauts from the previous Saturn trip, but they're sure that they're wishing the new crew well on their safe journey.
The next expedition to Saturn, yeah. Right. So it's going to start all over again is the way the movie leaves you.
Yeah.
But the janitor starts sweeping up what's left of the guy and putting him in the trash can, and it's really, like you said, kind of poignant. It's like, man, that's all that's left of the guy is just being thrown away in the trash.
Yeah. I mean,
it's sad.
He's essentially an American hero, you know? I mean, he's
an astronaut. Yeah, he went on a mission and came back and died in service. And that's all...
In secret. No one even knew that he died.
Yeah, the military kept what was going, because it only spans like a day or two.
Yeah.
And they didn't say what happened. As a matter of fact, the general public thinks he's still alive in a hospital.
Yeah, they actually, when the newscast that I was talking about, they actually say... You know, we're sure that wherever the astronauts are, they're sorry they can't be there to wish the new expedition well. So they believe that these guys are still alive and well.
Yeah. And that scene is just, so sad. It's like, man. I mean, it really kind of is heavy when you think about it. And the director, in watching the commentary, watching the interview with him, thought that was a humor thing. So how could you take, it's supposed to be a funny movie when he's bitching about his movie being recut or reshot.
Right.
He says, well, how can you take it seriously when the monster is scooped up and thrown in a trash can? And I'm like, you really don't understand, do you?
Well, the weird thing is he wrote this.
Yeah, he wrote it.
I almost feel like we can't be thinking this correctly if he wrote it and he thinks that's funny and he thinks that it's not supposed to be taken seriously because it's his movie. But at the same point,
but to me, it's so obvious that it's not funny.
It's like, how did you write that and not get it?
It's tragic and sad. It's like, this guy does not understand comedy at all. Well, you look at his career. I mean, he hasn't done anything that's really anybody has left an impact or anybody remembers really. Yeah.
Which is sad. I mean, I hate to say that about anybody's life. But
he's, you know, saying, oh, I was trying to, you know, this is supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be a parody of the site. I'm like, in no way, shape, or form does it play that way.
No, it doesn't. That was...
And especially that is a heavy scene.
It's a very heavy scene. And it was way more of an important and emotional scene than I expected to get from this movie.
Yeah, because the whole thing doesn't have that kind of weight.
There's nothing like that in this entire film.
Some of the scenes, the way they're shot with him walking alone, and you see him in silhouette against the sun or at the top of a hill, and that's kind of artsy looking. You know, that's bigger than the movie, those shots.
That's like he was talking about. He wanted to film a comic book is what he was trying to do, and that's what those scenes were supposed to be.
And the way some of the shots are framed now around the people talking and some of the like close-ups of the people like almost looking at the camera... And then there's that one split screen, which is weird because it's just one shot in the movie
with a giant green, bright green stripe down the middle.
I can see where he was trying to get that EC comic book, like he said.
Yeah.
Kind of look to the movie with the way some of the scenes are shot as comic panels.
Sure, I can see those.
And that's really glaringly obvious now that I know that.
Yeah. I don't know that I put that together until I
did comment when we were watching it that some of the shots were odd choices. And I couldn't put my finger on why, but now that
I guess that's why.
Boom, when it's a comic book that clicked, I'm like, oh well, it does kind of look like comic panels in a way, which is cool and kind of artsy.
Yeah.
But it's not to the degree where it really worked.
Yeah, it didn't necessarily work for the film, but it worked to look like
a comic. I can see that that's what he was trying to do.
Right.
And some of them, I see it does look like that a little bit, but not to the degree that he wanted it to.
Yeah.
Going by what he said. It's really neat. I'd urge anybody going, you know, give it a look, you know, give it a watch. It's pretty cool. Especially if you do like those, you know, It Came From Outer Space, Hideous Sun Demon, Quatermass, any of those types of movies like I Married a Monster from Outer Space.
Yeah.
It really does have that kind of feel to it, but it's done in the 70s. So you get a little more gore, a little more blood, and you got the nudity.
I would not say that anyone was necessarily a good actor in this.
Oh, God, no. No. Well, the only really good actor was Myron Healy. Okay, he comes from way back,
right,
playing heavies and stuff, 50s, 60s, et cetera, and probably before. He's the only one playing the general that's really worth a damn. The other doctor, the black guy who tells the other guy what's going on.
Right.
At the beginning.
He's but he just kind of disappears after a while. I think he goes home to go to bed and we never see him again.
Yeah, but the other people, the lead, his friend, the lead doctor, scientist, he's awful.
What was his name? Ted Nelson. Nelson? Nielsen. I don't know. I don't remember.
Dr. Ted.
Anyway, but they were all pretty awful.
Yeah, him and his wife. Watching
a lot of their scenes was quite the chore, which I think is why why I was so taken aback by those last, you know, couple of minutes of the film. It just really, it felt like a different film. Like it was.
It really did.
It was amazing.
It really did. And like I said, those last scenes are worth the whole picture, though.
They were.
But once again, it does feel like a lot of movies at that time. Mm. You can tell when it was made just by the pacing and the way the scenes are shot. And, there's a lot of nighttime scenes. No day for night stuff, though. It's not that cheap a movie.
We've seen a lot of that recently.
Oh, yeah. There is one scene, though, where I think they're in a kitchen. It's supposed to be night, but there's a lot of light coming in through the kitchen window. More so than the moon would give off.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of gory stuff, but it's nothing gross gory.
No.
You know, I mean, an arm gets chopped off,
but it's quick and
it's not lingering.
The most gory is just his face is melting constantly.
Yeah. Yeah. And the gore is like the after effects.
Yeah.
The arm gets chopped off. You don't really see it.
No.
But it happens. Then you see the arm.
Yeah.
His ear melts off, but
you don't see it happen.
But you see the ear on a tree in a pile of goo, and it kind of almost looks like an ear.
Yeah. Yeah, it took me a minute to actually see an ear. So
yeah. He attacks, the fisherman, who's actually one of the producers, I think.
Hmm.
And you see him attack him kind of, and it goes attack him off camera, and then he throws the head in the water. There's not a lot of blood dripping from it until it hits the rock. You see the nurse. Okay, the nurse that he attacks at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The camera when they pull the sheet off her in the morgue, and the camera goes around. You're like, well, what did he do? Because from the left side, there's nothing. It goes around the top of her head, and you see a little bit of the right side of her face with like the mandible,
mm-hmm.
the jaw, and then it cuts away. I'm like, man, that would have looked really cool.
Yeah.
It's
like you just get a sneak of what it could have been cool to see, but you didn't really see it.
It's great that it did that,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
because then it can play to a younger audience and not, I guess it did to get an R rating, but,
well, and you know, just like we say in other things, your imagination fills in the blanks and it does a great job. Yeah.
And I think that is one of the things that Rob Bottin, where he was apprenticing for Rick Baker at the time, and he worked on the nurse. The nurse head prop there.
I see.
But yeah, you know, I would say any age could kind of watch this. It's not that bad. And even the nudity in it is marginal and innocent.
Yeah, I barely remember it.
Yeah, which Cheryl Rainbow Smith, who was, you know, nude or topless and tons of stuff in the 70s, she's wearing a tube top and shorts.
Right.
Yeah, smarmy photographers taking pictures of her. She's modeling outside, and then he says, well, okay, come on, take your top off. And she's like, no, I don't want to. And they argue, and he pulls her top off. And he's taking pictures, and she's trying to get away, and he's taking pictures, and she's just there with her, you know, tits hanging out.
Mm-hmm.
And for a couple of seconds, and that's it. It's not even a sex scene or anything.
No.
It's like they said, we got to have some nudity in here, you know, because to get people to see it, you know. it's like a flash, basically.
Yeah, that's
true. But Grindhouse, Drive-In, you got to have it. Other than the little bit of gore and the flash of, you know, of boobs there, it could be, you know, a 50s monster from space movie.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be interesting to edit it like that, you know, to take those little bits out, because most of the violence does happen off camera.
Right.
But to take out those little bits that would make it an R, and take out the nudity, because that scene is really nothing.
Yeah.
The only reason is there because she's backing away from the guy, and her leg hits the arm of the fisherman body or something.
Right.
But to take those out and then switch it to black and white.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that'd be kind of cool. Because, you know, if you think about it, even the dripping effects, it's kind of gross, but it's not that gross because you don't see the skin a lot. It's like it's just a goop with eyes and a mouth. And if you think about Quatermass, you know, where he had the big cactus arm,
right?
You know, and his face is kind of leprous, you know, looks like leprosy kind of.
Mm-hmm.
it's not a whole lot of difference gross-wise between those two. That would be kind of neat to see. Because if you think, you know, also too, if you take, you know, Quatermass Experiment, Creeping Unknown, the first one, and you take that guy and then insert a couple things of him, you know, ripping the head off of somebody or maybe punching that big ass arm through somebody, you know, and then have, you know, have a flash of nudity in it, colorize it, boom, you've updated it. I mean, that's really all it would take. That's one, you know, I have to get with Craig. Maybe we'll do that on a podcast because Craig is my Quatermass buddy there. We both really love that, especially that first movie. But Professor Quatermass, Brian Donlevy playing Quatermass, and is such a dick. He's great in that. Maybe we'll do a podcast on the Quatermass movies. Hey, speaking of, while I'm thinking about it, speaking of future podcast coming up soon, I think the very next episode is going to be one we've talked about for a long, long time doing, and we're finally getting around to do it. One of my brother from another mother, Clayton Sayer, and I are going to finally get together and do a podcast. We've talked about it for a while, and we finally are going to make it happen. I believe the next episode, we're going to be recording it soon this week. It had to happen.
Of course it did.
Planet of the Apes. Yes, we're going to talk about not just the Planet of the Apes, the first movie, but the entire series of the original five movies. And, you know, we'll go into, of course, everything, the TV show, the cartoon, the merchandising. Good God, it's going to be one of the longest podcasts we've ever recorded.
Yeah, you may have to break it up into two.
It might, because, I mean, Clayton, we've had these discussions of Planet of the Apes because we just love the film. So we just talk about them, God, over the last 20 years.
Right.
And we can just talk for hours about this stuff. And it'll be interesting to see what, you know, to get it recorded and see what happens.
It will indeed. So you can look forward to that.
Yeah.
So I'll look forward to editing it.
Oh, yeah. That's actually, it may have to be the podcast after because it may take you too long to edit that.
We'll see how it goes.
But back to Incredible Melting Man for a second. I guess we can go ahead and, you know, do you have anything else on that you want to throw in there?
No, I think we covered everything that I found interesting.
We actually talked longer than I expected to on the movie.
Yeah, I wasn't real sure that we'd have a lot to say about it. We didn't really go off on too many tangents or anything, so I think I'm good.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, once again, as I say, and I say once again a lot of you, know, isn't it?
I have.
I caught myself doing that a lot. So furthermore, how about that?
Furthermore, I'll probably cut that out.
As I say always, if you get a chance, check the movie out yourself. Watch it and, you know, make your own judgments. You know, listen to what we've said here. And if you agree, cool. If you don't, that's cool, too.
Yeah, let us know. Chime in.
But yeah, hey, drop us a line, you know, on the Facebook page and let us know if we're full of crap or if you agree with us or what have you, or drop us a line at phantasmoad@gmail.com. That's phantasmoad@gmail.com. That's it for this episode.
I think that's
Incredible
it.
Melting Man. Check back on. Oh, and by the way, we're on Podbean and Stitcher and iTunes. So tell a friend.
Yeah, whatever's easier.
And join
on
us,
you.
Won't you? All right. So that's it for this time. Incredible Melting Man for me and for Phyllis. Good night.
Good night.